Boulder science writer Florence Williams set out to write a book about breasts and their susceptibility to toxins and disease. But she couldn't ignore the fascination society has with breasts, not to mention the many names people have for them, which she addresses in the introduction.
Fun bags, boobsters, chumbawambas, dingle bobbers, dairy pillows, jelly bonkers, num-nums. When I was growing up, my mother called them ninnies. That word, according to Webster's, means fools, and lists nitwits, nutcases, and boobs as synonyms.
Williams' new book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, and it covers the science and the sociology of breasts. Williams told CPR's Andrea Dukakis there's debate over why women have them in the first place.
Breasts are incredibly unique in the animal kingdom. For example, we get these rounded swellings on our chest at puberty, and we have them all the way through our adult lives, whereas other primates only have these swellings while they're lactating, and then they recede. And so in anthropological circles, it's sort of a big question. Well, why, you know, how did we get so lucky? And so the debate really comes down to, did breasts evolve as sexual signals for men, which is what many anthropologists have thought for many decades, or did they evolve so that the fat in breasts could somehow help the survival of the woman and her infant?
How did you end up writing a book about breasts?
I ended up writing this book because, as a science journalist, I had seen research reports that toxic chemicals were showing up in breast milk. And at the time, I was nursing my daughter. And I thought it might be a great way to tell the story as a journalist if I tested my own breast milk. Plus, as a mother, I just wanted to find out what this really meant and you know, what my levels were if I had any. So I sent a vial of my breast milk to a lab in Germany, and they tested it. And it came back positive for flame retardants and a jet fuel ingredient, pesticides, and also dioxin, which is a known carcinogen. You know, these were just a few chemicals that they tested for, but, you know, it turns out that we all have hundreds of industrial chemicals coursing through our bloodstream. And it turns out that breasts, because they're so fatty, attract a lot of these chemicals. And the breast is really good at converting them into breast milk, unfortunately.
Did it make you hesitant to breastfeed? Did you look into the sort of cost benefit of these toxins versus all of the benefits of breastfeeding that research has found?
Yeah, sure. It definitely gave me pause. At this point, I'd already nursed one child, so this was my second child. It made me think, wow, what did I give my first child? I talked to a lot of experts. I did sort of cost-benefit. And it turns out that there's really a widespread consensus that the benefits of breastfeeding far outweigh the risks. You know, we're also learning more and more all the time about the amazing substances in breast milk that we never knew existed before. And if anything, these seem to sort of help compensate, you know, for the bad things in breast milk. And they may even help protect kids from the effects of toxic chemicals. I think it's also important to point out that formula, also has contaminants in it. And the water it's mixed with certainly is filled with all kinds of things like pesticides. And it's also important to point out that breast milk is just one exposure, you know, that these kids or the infants are getting. The primary exposure really comes during gestation through the placenta. And so I look at the breasts and the breast milk as just an obvious and visual symbol of these exposures that we're all getting all the time.
And you talk about the fatty tissue that breasts have. And does that make breasts vulnerable to other medical conditions and diseases?
It turns out that breasts are pretty vulnerable. They're in such great conversation with the world around us all the time, and that's how they evolved. It's how they're supposed to be. Breasts are filled with estrogen and progesterone receptors. That's how the breast tissue knows when to start developing in puberty. It's also how the breast knows when to start making more of the dairy machinery when you're pregnant. So your breast is always, it's always conversing with the rest of your body, but it's also picking up these cues from the environment. And so we know that modern life has changed breasts in some interesting ways.
Early puberty, you talk about that in your book. How is that affecting sort of the onset of breasts? How much earlier are girls starting to get breasts, and how early are kids hitting puberty?
It turns out that girls are developing breasts younger than ever before. We know that, for example, African-American girls, one third of them will start growing breasts between the ages of 6 and 8.
Mm.
And it's about 10% of white girls and I think 15% of Hispanic girls. And overall, about a third of girls will start developing breasts by the time they're 9 or 10. And this is about a year earlier than 15 or 20 years ago.
And the big question is why?
Right. The big question is why. It looks like the main driver of early puberty is diet. Unfortunately, children, just like adults, are bigger than ever. And one third of children are overweight or obese. So we know there's a relationship between body weight and the timing of puberty. But actually, it doesn't really seem to explain the whole phenomenon. For example, there was a recent study in Denmark that looked at girls who are developing breasts 1 year earlier than they did 15 years ago, and yet their weight is virtually the same. And so the researcher is trying to understand what else is going on, and she's tested the hormone levels of these girls to see if maybe they're producing more estrogen in their bodies, and she found that they really weren't, which makes her think that the source of estrogen is coming from somewhere else, for example, from food or chemicals in our environment that mimic estrogen.
Is there anything wrong or troubling about early puberty?
Parents are concerned about this because we know that girls who enter puberty earlier are at higher risk for breast cancer later on. And we also know that these girls who go through puberty earlier are more at risk for depression. They're more at risk for substance abuse. You know, I think in any child, it's hard to be different from your peers. But I also think as parents, there are some things we can try to do to, you know, delay it a little bit. For example, there seems to be a relationship between fiber in the diet and the timing of puberty. The higher the fiber in the diet, the later the puberty. And there are some studies that indicate that eating meat might also promote early puberty. So I think if we can keep our girls, you know, athletic, and if we can give them healthy diets, that's a really great start. And it's good for all sorts of things, not just early puberty.
Boulder science writer Florence Williams is speaking with CPR's Andrea Dukakis. Williams' new book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. We'll have more, including why breasts are getting larger on average, after a break. This is Colorado Matters on Colorado Public Radio. This is Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner. We're talking about the new book, Breasts, by Boulder science writer Florence Williams. She told CPR's Andrea Dukakis that the modern diet is changing the size of breasts.
We know that breasts are getting bigger. Cup sizes are bigger. This is something that the bra manufacturers talk a lot about. They say the average size of the American breast used to be a 34B, you know, even 15 years ago.
And this isn't only artificial.
Right. This isn't only artificial. You know, implants are only in about 5% of women. But overall, now these lingerie companies are saying, you know, their average sizes that they're selling are, you know, 34 and 36 C, D, double D. They talk a lot about this demand for increased cup sizes. And it turns out that this is also a result of our diet. You know, American women's bodies are getting bigger everywhere. And of course, some of us gain more weight in our breasts than others, but that seems to be happening.
Well, this is also the 50th anniversary of breast implants, and you actually traveled to Texas to talk to the first recipient of a breast implant.
Yeah, this was a fun story. I found the woman who got the first breast implants, silicone breast implants, in 1962. At the time, she was about 30 years old, and she actually went into the hospital because she had a tattoo on her chest that she wanted to get removed. And I guess she sort of walked into the wrong room because she walked into the room of the doctor who had just invented the silicone breast implant, and he was looking for a human guinea pig. He had implanted it in a dog named Esmeralda already. Esmeralda really didn't like it. She ended up chewing it out. So Timmy Jean said that she really didn't want breast implants. She'd never thought her breasts, you know, were problematic. But she said she wanted to get her ears pinned back. And the doctor said, well, I'll make you a deal. I'll pin back your ears if you agree to get breast implants. And so she did. And the amazing thing is she's been walking around with the same ones for 50 years.
But they haven't exactly been a success for her.
Well, like many of the early generation implants, hers had problems. They ruptured and they turned hard. She's gone through periods where she's had shooting pains in her chest. But, you know, she never joined this largest class action suit in the history of the United States against implant manufacturers in the 90s. She never tried to get her implants removed. At this point, she just doesn't want another major surgery. But she was very loyal to those doctors who used her as a guinea pig. And I think there's a part of her that's really proud that she's a part of this medical history.
How safe and prevalent are these implants now?
Well, implants have improved a lot over the years, fortunately. They're now made with much tougher shells, so they don't break open as often. And the gel inside them now is much stiffer. It's sort of like a gummy bear, so that if the shell ruptures, the implant is not supposed to move around anywhere. Although there are still some surprising side effects associated with breast implants that we don't hear that much about. For example, they still turn hard. We know that the average shelf life of a breast implant is only 5 to 10 years. So women who get them are kind of buying into repeated surgeries, and they still do leak open sometimes. We know that sometimes there are visual problems with implants. For example, the implants sometimes migrate together, and this causes a visual known as bread loafing or sometimes uniboob. Or sometimes there are effects called double bubble. I think it's a decision to be made, I think, after a lot of discussion with your doctor and just knowledge that it's a major surgical procedure and not really just a minor product, you know, that you're buying that sometimes I think the plastic surgery industry, you know, would like you to believe.
You know, when we talk about breasts these days, a lot of the talk is around breast cancer and the prevalence of it. What do we know about the rates now of breast cancer?
We know that breast cancer incidence has increased a lot in this country, especially since the 1940s. It started to level off a little bit in the last 10 years. But globally, breast cancer is really taking off. It's expected to increase 20% by 2020. And globally, it's the number one cancer killer of women.
And why is this? Are we more aware of it, too? Or is there something in the environment or somewhere else that's affecting the numbers?
That's a great question. We're certainly better at detecting breast cancer, especially as mammography becomes more popular around the world. But I think it's pretty well agreed upon that the rise in breast cancer isn't totally explained by mammography. And for example, in China, which is so rapidly industrializing, we know that women are getting breast cancer on average 10 years earlier than women are getting it here. We know that the risk factors for breast cancer now, things like family history, whether you smoke, what your weight is, your reproductive history, all of those things only account for about half of all breast cancers. So people are really wondering what else is going on.
You also write about how, in some ways, the military is leading the charge on breast cancer research. Why?
There's an emerging male breast cancer cluster on a military base in North Carolina. About 74 men have come forward with breast cancer who all at one time lived or served on Camp Lejeune. It turns out that Camp Lejeune had the most contaminated groundwater supply ever discovered in the United States. It had a number of known or probable human carcinogens at levels sometimes 200 times the safe level for these chemicals. And there are actually many diseases emerging out of this base. But male breast cancer is such a rare disease. So when you see a number of men showing up with it, it really raises some alerts. And the federal government, the Centers for Disease Control, is looking really hard at these men. In some ways, it's easier to study breast cancer in men because their lives aren't complicated by things like reproductive history or age at puberty or whether they take hormone replacement therapy or how long they breastfed. It's really a simpler relationship sometimes between a potential carcinogen and cancer. And so if there is a link here between the chemicals in the water and the cancer, it would actually be the first time that we have been able to pinpoint a chemical cause of breast cancer. So it would be a really big deal. And it's kind of ironic that it's men who might help solve the puzzle of a women's disease.
That's science writer Florence Williams speaking with CPR's Andrea Dukakis. Williams lives in Boulder, and her new book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. Andrea and Eric Whitney produced today's show with help from Kelly Griffin and our audio engineer David Fender. Follow us on Facebook. We're CPR News. And the show is on Twitter at Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner at Colorado Public Radio.